From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Wednesday edition, the dust is still settling from yesterday's election, and both the Republicans and Democrats made gains and sustained losses. Are there any signs of political trends in the making that so many are looking for as we head into the 2020 election cycle? Well, Scott Rasmussen is here with the answer to that question. But first, on Monday, a Mexican drug cartel brutally slaughtered 9 members of a Mormon family in an attack in northern Mexico. Yesterday, President Trump tweeted, quote, "If Mexico needs or requests help in cleaning out these monsters, the United States stands ready." In just a moment, I'll talk with Brandon Darby, managing director and editor-in-chief of Breitbart Texas, who also co-founded the Cartel Chronicles. And China's brutal suppression of religious freedom continues to be exposed. FRC's Travis Weber is in studio with me later to discuss that topic. Also, I'll be joined by David Clawson, FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, to pick up where we left off yesterday with the news that climate experts are now calling for population control to address the climate crisis. As Christians, how should we respond to A, the so-called climate crisis, and B, this now open call for population control? We'll talk about it later here on Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you happen to be on Twitter, it's at TPerkins. All right, 3 Mormon mothers set out Monday morning in a caravan of SUVs, leaving their isolated religious hamlet in northern Mexico with 14 children in tow. Wary of the drug cartels that patrol the region, families like theirs knew to travel by day to avoid the danger, and they knew to travel together. But the women had not ventured far when, for reasons that are still unclear, armed attackers descended on them. Gunmen sprayed one of the SUVs with bullets, then set it on fire, killing one mother and her 4 children. A few miles east, gunmen opened fire on the other vehicles, killing the 2 other mothers and 2 more children. Several other children were injured and airlifted to a hospital. All told, 9 members of the Mormon family, dual U.S.-Mexican citizens, were killed in the attack in northern Mexico. Now, yesterday, as I mentioned, President Trump tweeted, quote, "A wonderful family and friends from Utah got caught between 2 vicious drug cartels who were shooting at each other, with the result being many great American people killed, including young children and some missing. If Mexico needs or requests help in cleaning out these monsters, the United States stands ready and willing and able to get involved and do the job quickly and effectively." He goes on to say, the great new president of Mexico has made this a big issue, but the cartels have become so large and powerful that you sometimes need an army to defeat an army. This is the time for Mexico, with the help of the United States, to wage war on the drug cartels and wipe them off the face of the earth. We merely await a call from your great new president, end quote. Joining me now is Brandon Darby, managing director and editor-in-chief of Breitbart Texas. He co-founded the Cartel Chronicles in 2014. And while the mainstream media reporting on the Mexican drug cartel has been lacking and even inaccurate, Brandon and his Cartel Chronicle team at Breitbart have done a great job of reporting on this issue. Brandon, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, it's an honor to be on your show. Thank you.
Let me just start with this, Brandon. Is this, you know, the president's been criticized for talking about these monsters south of the border and his efforts to try to protect our border from keeping murderers and criminals from coming across. Is this what he's talking about?
It is what he's talking about. You know, I could raise a little bit of issue. I wish that people would understand or consider that there are millions upon millions of good people in northern Mexico on the border. And there are a lot of paramilitary transnational criminal organizations that control the lives of those good people. You know, millions of those good people, they pray to God for help because they live in a situation where their journalists routinely get murdered anytime they write about corruption. When people show up to kill them for the cartel, it's usually the state police or the city police or the Mexican army. That is the reality of what is going on in Mexico. So we are affected by those cartels, and the people a lot of times in Mexico are affected by those cartels. So the president, when he talks about what's happening there, he is indeed accurate. I do wish he would spend more time talking about the people there who are affected by them. But the president is accurate.
Well, let me ask you this, Brandon. When you first heard about this, I mean, just brutal, brutal attack that took place, including the killing of these children, shooting these children, were you surprised that this was done by a Mexican cartel, that they were capable of such brutality?
No, not at all. I was surprised by the specific groups. I was surprised that it happened in that area. You know, our border is roughly 2,000 miles long. It's mostly controlled by Sinaloa cartel-aligned groups, and they tend to not be as brutal toward the average citizen as some of the cartels that we deal with in Texas. Like on the Texas border, we have the Gulf Cartel. They're very brutal to families and to journalists and to kids, and they kill babies. We have Los Zetas. They're very brutal. But typically, those are the two that do the brutal things like this. I was very surprised that this happened where it happened, but I wasn't surprised that it happened because we report on things like this all the time in Mexico. It's not as egregious. It's not usually U.S. citizens, women and children targeted, but sometimes it is women and children targeted. And so it isn't out of the norm that cartels are this brutal. Certain cartels. It is out of the norm for the cartels who operate over there.
I mean, we're talking the six children that were murdered ranged in age from 8 months to 12 years. I mean, it's just it's horrific, and the descriptions of what we've read has occurred. In part, I think, Brandon, probably your point is that these were American citizens, dual citizens, and so it's gotten attention because they were Americans. But you're saying that this happens routinely to Mexican citizens and others who live there in that along that border in Mexico.
Right. Very close to our border in Texas, in Mexico, in a town called Allende, in a state called Coahuila, not long ago, less than a decade ago, two men from this region of Mexico, from Allende, had decided to work with the DEA and testify for them. They got caught. And all the U.S. government did was contacted Mexico like they're supposed to and said, we have two of your citizens. Here's their last names. And this is where we caught them. So that information was leaked from the Mexican government to Los Zetas, this brutal Mexican cartel operating on our border. And the Zetas said, hey, these are two common last names, and we know that these guys are going to testify against us, but we don't know exactly who they are. So let's just round up everyone in the area who has those last names, even though they're common last names, and let's just kill them all. And they did. They went in and they killed hundreds of people. They burned their bodies in a network of ovens. And this is routine stuff. It is the most heinous. It's like ISIS is horrible, but ISIS really doesn't have much on these cartels, or at least they're very comparable. And one is across the ocean and one is right here on our border, you know? And yes, ISIS attacks Christian communities in the Middle East, but you know what? The people who are living through the terror of these cartels, they're also Christians and they're our neighbors and they're Christians and they pray to the same Jesus Christ that we pray to. And oftentimes their voices are just marginalized. In media, if you look right now at the Los Angeles Times, which I don't suggest you do, but if you look at the headline they wrote about this case, one of the headlines is family attacked by cartel in Mexico has long history of violence. And they found some guy in the family from 40 years ago who did something stupid. And they're smearing the women and children who were murdered yesterday, or 2 days ago. They're smearing these women and children because they want to protect the narrative that the border is safe. And so what happens in the United States is so many people in media, they don't want to write about what's going on the border and in Mexico and the horrors that are occurring because they're afraid that if they do, it's going to support Trump or it's going to support Republican calls for border security. And then so many people on the right don't want to talk about it because they're afraid if they do, it's going to support Democrat calls for asylum claims and what have you. So these people, these millions of people who are fellow Christians, are just ignored. They're marginalized. They're the least of these. These aren't people trying to come here illegally. These aren't people trying to even come here. They're people living in these communities, trying to make it better, and very powerless to actually do so. They don't have a 911 to call. They don't have the Second Amendment. They don't have any mechanism to fight back, and they have no governmental bodies to help them. And they're just ignored. And so this is what happens when organized crime gangs are allowed to run the country and allowed to run regions of the country. This is what goes on there pretty routinely. Yesterday was more egregious because it was specifically women and children in vehicles in a large scale attack. But it's not really that far out of the norm.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us. Brandon Darby of Breitbart, Texas, my guest. Brandon, and when you mentioned ISIS, that was the first thing that came to mind when I read the description of what occurred. That was the same image that I've seen, and heard from the Middle East. What's the status of this particular case? What have authorities thus far uncovered?
Well, they're shifting blame between one cartel group to another. It is accurate to say it was probably what we call the Sinaloa cartel, but there are many different cartels that make up that federation. They're shifting blame. They're saying it was most likely there was a lot of gun battles in that state that day and prior. They're saying that they believe other cartels saw convoys. They were in cars similar to what the cartels usually use. So they attacked the convoys. Not realizing what they were, that it was women and children. And that's probably the most likely case. If some news reports said that they were targeted, shot in the back and assaulted and sexually, and those things, I don't think are true. I think that it was probably, they assumed it was another cartel, in order for this to have happened. It was a very hot area. I would like to hope that's what happened and that these guys didn't specifically target. Like I said, if this were in the Zetas territory or the Gulf Cartel territory, it would be completely like them to do this. But it's really not in standard operating procedures for Sinaloa aligned groups to specifically target women and children. They tend to not do that.
Hey, Brandon, we're up against a break. I want to ask you a very quick question before we run out of time here. The president, President Trump, tweeting out to the new Mexican president saying, "We'll help if you want it." Any chance the Mexican president will ask for U.S. help to crack down on these cartels?
No chance at all. Not going to happen.
Okay. All right. Well, we hope something happens to bring law and order to that region of Mexico. Brandon, thanks so much for joining us and appreciate the work that you do on the Cartel Chronicles.
Thank you.
All right, folks. This once again underscores the dangerous world in which we live and the evil that is out there. It doesn't do any good to bury your head in the sand. All right, when we come back, what do we read into yesterday's election? Anything? We talk with Scott Rasmussen on the other side of the break. Don't go away. More Washington Watch to come.
Abortion is one of the most combative and sensitive moral and political questions in America today, even among Christians. There has been a renewed effort in theological liberal Christian circles to argue that the Bible does not oppose abortion. In light of these arguments, it is crucial for Christians to know what the Bible actually says about abortion. Does the Bible teach that life begins at conception or birth? Is abortion murder? In FRC's new publication titled Biblical Principles for Pro-Life Engagement, Personhood, Scripture, and Church History, author David Clausen addresses these questions with relevant passages in the Bible that inform how a Christian should think about abortion, the question of personhood, and a survey of how prominent church leaders have interpreted these passages throughout history. Learn more by visiting frc.org/unborn. That's frc.org/unborn.
Meadow Pollock was a high school senior who was tragically gunned down during the Parkland school shooting in Florida. In an emotional and gripping FRC Speaker Series event, her father, Andrew Pollock, and education expert Max Eden discussed the tragic massacre and the politically correct policies that allowed the Parkland shooting to happen. The Southern Poverty Law Center and the Obama administration promoted a false narrative that teachers and principals were racist and couldn't be trusted to enforce rules with consequences. Instead, they argued for healing circles and restorative justice. These policies enabled a psychopathic criminal to maintain a clean background and purchase a firearm used to murder 17 people at the high school. The Obama administration forced these leniency policies into hundreds of schools, serving millions of students across America. To listen to this event and to learn more, visit frc.org/speakers. That's frc.org/speakers.
Religious liberty is one of the most important yet misunderstood issues in America. There's a growing perception that protecting religious liberty is an attempt to lawfully allow bigotry and prejudice. Therefore, Christians need to be able to articulate with greater clarity and persuasiveness why they support religious liberty. Biblical Principles for Religious Liberty, Evidence from Scripture and Church History, is a new publication from Family Research Council that presents biblical and theological arguments for why religious liberty is worth defending and encourages Christians to engage in the fight to preserve America's first freedom. This publication presents key biblical texts that support a broad understanding of religious freedom and key theological arguments based on those texts. In an increasingly secular world, Christians must understand and advocate for religious liberty. Learn more by visiting frc.org/belief.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us. Well, both Republicans and Democrats made gains and sustained losses yesterday. Are there any signs of the political trends in the making that so many are looking for as we head into the 2020 election cycle? Well, joining me now is Scott Rasmussen, well known for his polling at scottrasmussen.com and the author of the book entitled The Sun Is Still Rising, Politics Has Failed, But America Will Not. Scott, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, it's great to be with you.
Hey, all right. I'm going to start with this question. Any surprises from the outcomes of yesterday's election?
Well, it's a little bit of a surprise that Matt Bevin lost in the Kentucky governor's race, but not a big surprise. The polling had shown that fairly close down the stretch. You know, perhaps it's a surprise to some who think Donald Trump won the state by 30 points, or Republicans should win easily there. But there's two things that I noticed coming out of yesterday. First is the ongoing tendency of analysts and pundits to overestimate and overanalyze these off-year elections. They aren't really as significant as we sometimes think they are, but they do provide some clues. And the clues that came yesterday tend to confirm what we already know. Republicans are struggling in affluent, in college-educated areas of inner suburbs. Donald Trump does a tremendous job of energizing the Democratic base to get out and vote. One of the big questions will be how energized the Republican base is. And Donald Trump has his following is very similar to what it was in 2016, but it's not automatically transferable to somebody else. Most Republicans did pretty well in Kentucky, but again, Governor Bevin was just unable to overcome the unpopularity of some of his administration.
Well, speaking of Bevin, let's start there because he was down double digits in recent polling and came, that was a very, very close race. I mean, that's less than one vote per precinct in the state. I mean, is that 5,100, roughly 5,100 votes separated the two? So very, very close race. Again, underscoring why every vote matters when you consider does my vote count? But I would, my take on that would be that the president actually helped get him a lot closer to the finish line than he probably would have on his own.
Absolutely. The president was clearly an asset in Kentucky, and he will be an asset in other races. But You know, one of the things that I hear a lot from supporters of the president is, well, the polling is all wrong. He's much more popular than he is. He can make anything happen. He's cruising to victory in 2020. You know, there should be a wake-up call. The president was an asset to Governor Bevin. He did help him make it a very close race. But, you know, the polling, the reality of the world that we're in today is something where every vote does count. And as I said earlier, this president energizes Democrats every bit as much as Barack Obama energized Republicans when he was in office. And so the question is, in 2020, will the Republican voters, will the Trump supporters and those who have their doubts about the president show up and vote?
That's an extremely important point, and I think something that was underscored in yesterday's election, not only in the president energizing Democratic voters, but we saw that overall in turnout. We saw some very high right. turnouts in different parts of the country, which, quite frankly, is good. I like to see people voting. But the point is, the 2020 elections, just as yesterday's elections, will be decided by who turns out and votes.
Right. You know, the New York Times did an interesting survey project recently in the six states that were closest in election 2016. They're all toss-up states. And the big takeaway from the results is they're still all toss-up states. You know, among registered voters in the New York Times survey, Biden is either up a couple of points over the president in most of them, or even Sanders and Warren don't do quite as well as Biden. But in all cases, among registered voters, a year out from the election, these states are toss-ups. If it's a toss-up among registered voters, then it's a question of who shows up to vote. And, you know, I want to be clear on this. I don't think a poll taken a year ahead of time is going to predict exactly what the numbers will look like next November. But it suggests that the political world that we're in today is not a whole lot different than it was in 2016. And we know how close that election was.
Yes. Well, again, looking at using Kentucky as an example, America is divided ideologically, and there's very little middle ground anymore. It's you stand on one side or the other, and that's why we see increasingly these closely decided races where just a handful of votes, one way or the other, determines the outcome.
That's right. And you know, I do think it's important to recognize that we are much more divided politically than we are as a society. But in the political world,
yes,
it has become a team sport. And, you know, we very rarely used to see something that you and I remember from, not too long ago. There used to be times when a state would vote for one party for the U.S. senator and the other party for the Electoral College.
Yes.
That very rarely happens anymore. We now are lining up with red and blue states. One of the outcomes yesterday was that Virginia is now clearly establishing itself as a blue state. And, you know, these things, this team sport nature of politics, creates a very toxic atmosphere.
I don't think it's good.
No, it's not good. No.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the politics doesn't necessarily reflect everything in our society. But I think back to when I was in office, less than 20 years ago, and we had a Republican speaker pro tem in the House and a Democratic speaker. We were bipartisan in everything that we did. That's not the case anymore in my home state of Louisiana. And as you pointed out, most states either go one way or the other.
Yes. And it's become to the point where, some surveys show that parents would be upset if their child dated somebody or married somebody from the other party. It is no longer considered the loyal opposition. Many Democrats consider Republicans to be evil, and many Republicans say the same about Democrats. In fact, if we ran a polling question and said Republicans believe the sky is blue, Democrats would disagree. That's just where we are in political.
Well, Scott, we got to leave it there for today, but we'll pick up that conversation later. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, Scott Rasmussen. To find out more, go to TonyPerkins.com. I trust his judgment. All right, don't go away. Coming back with more, Travis Weber joins me with the latest publication on China. More on their abuses next. Don't go away.
The topic of sexual sin can be difficult to discuss in the church, but it's something that needs to be addressed. To help inform this conversation, FRC has a new publication for church leaders called Safeguard Your Ministry from Moral Failure. In it, Dr. Jesse Gill, a licensed psychologist, specifically addresses sexual sin and the susceptibility of those in church leadership. He discusses the contributing factors to moral failure, a practical understanding of our sexual nature, and a call for Christian leaders to increase their dependency on Christ. The principles found in this publication will instruct leaders in meeting their emotional, relational, and even sexual needs in healthy ways so that there will be less of a foothold for temptation. Safeguard Your Ministry for Moral Failure is a must-read for everyone involved in church ministry. To read the publication and learn more, visit frc.org/safeguard. That's frc.org/safeguard.
Are you a parent of a school-aged child? If so, then you understand that navigating your educational system is one of the biggest challenges facing families across the United States today. Family Research Council's new publication titled, The SPLC's Teaching Tolerance, What Parents, Teachers, and Administrators Need to Know, helps parents identify and monitor a specific agenda that is being pushed on their children in public schools. The highly partisan left-wing Southern Poverty Law Center is one of the greatest offenders on this front with their program titled Teaching Tolerance. This program is designed to infiltrate schools with radically progressive education resources that undermine Christian values about marriage and family. FRC's brochure outlines the content within the SPLC's Teaching Tolerance Project and empowers parents to protect their children against the SPLC's agenda. Learn more at frc.org/teachingtolerance. That's frc.org/teachingtolerance.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us. The website, once again, tonyperkins.com. If you happen to be on Twitter, you can keep up with me at T Perkins. All right, the Family Research Council just released a new paper written by Ariel Del Turco. It's entitled Religious Freedom in China, the History, Current Challenges, and the Proper Response to a Human Rights Crisis. Now, this is something we're talking about quite frequently on this program because China has such a profound impact upon the world. I mean, it is a power to be dealt with. The United States currently engaged in negotiations over trade. You know, we've talked about 20 years ago when they were engaged in discussions with the United States over permanent most favored nation status in terms of trade. There was all this talk about how if we engaged them economically, we could change them. Well, the evidence suggests 20 years later that when we see what's happening with the NBA and other American businesses when it comes to Hong Kong and doing business in China, that quite frankly, American businesses have been changed more than China. Joining me now to talk about religious freedom in China and the growing abuses there is Travis Weber, Vice President of Policy here at the Family Research Council and of Government Affairs. Travis, welcome back.
Thank you, Tony.
Let's talk first about this new publication just released this week, what it covers and the purpose here.
Sure, Tony. So this is it's an important topic, obviously, as you mentioned, religious freedom for us at FRC. We're increasingly trying to make sure that people understand how much of a worldwide crisis this is, and particularly one of the areas where it is a significant problem is in China. So hence the reason for the paper. We wanted to provide people a one-stop shop kind of reference piece for this. So in this paper, we go through the history of religious freedom in China, the history of abuses, the more recent history of the Communist Party, and that government ideology, which leads to religious freedom abuses, which really leads to this understanding of religion being granted by the state, religious freedom being granted, not coming from God. This is at the core of what leads to their approach, which, you know, the government says to the citizens, you should be happy you're getting this freedom from us. The opposite of the American approach, whereby we understand religious freedom comes from God. So we overview this, then kind of get into some of the specifics and the history of persecution of different Christian groups, Protestants, house churches, Catholics, others, and then other religious groups in China, the Uyghur Muslims, Tibetan Buddhists, Falun Gong, and others, and then discuss what we can do about it, some congressional and other administration actions that we can take against religious freedom violators around the world. We discuss all of that in this paper, which is now available on our website at frc.org/China.
All right. I'm going to ask a very basic, fundamental question that maybe some of our listeners are thinking right now. Why should I care about religious freedom in China?
Tony, I think to get at that, we need to understand that as Christians, we have an obligation to advocate for those who cannot advocate for themselves. We still have incredible freedom here in America. We can pray without fear of being harassed by the government knocking on our door. We can take action with regard to our own government, urging them to stand up for religious freedom around the world, our elected officials. So we still have this freedom to act and advocate for our fellow believers, brothers and sisters in China who cannot advocate for themselves. This is really at the core of it.
And as believers were commanded to do so, Paul – well, I think Paul is the writer of Hebrews. In Hebrews, we're told to consider those who are in chains and to pray for them and to uphold them. But I also would say in addition to that, is from a very practical standpoint that China is exporting – it's tyranny. Just as America under this administration is working hard to promote religious freedom globally, China is working just as hard to promote its brand of tyranny. And as it influences with its money and with its resources, it is encouraging other governments to crack down on religious freedom.
It is. And Tony, you'll recall recently one of the issues that emerged onto the world stage was China's treatment of its Uyghur population. A number of countries, including the United States, spoke out against this. China had its own group of countries that came to its defense, claiming right. that it was acting properly in the Uyghur Xinjiang area. This is playing out on a mega level at the world stage, and we need to have our voice in it, as President Trump has been doing, and making sure that the China human rights issue is not gone unaddressed. We have to remember, this regime we're dealing with now is the same regime. It comes from the same origins as the regime which in the late 50s implemented policies which led to the deaths of 35 to 45 million people under the so-called Great Leap Forward. Bad policy caused death, millions of deaths in China. And we need to realize that the massive threat when we see a regime coming from a different place and understanding of human dignity and human rights.
Yeah, Mao Zedong in his crackdown. But then we have this second wave under President Xi that is cracking down on religious expression across the board, as you point out, not just Christians, but all religious people. Finding themselves in some cases in prison, as we talked about the Uyghurs, and we're going to talk more about this, about what's happening with the Uyghurs in particular, because it's just atrocious. All right, folks, Travis is going to stick around here. We're going to go into a break. We're going to come back on the other side of the break. We're going to continue our conversation on China. But also coming up, David Clawson is going to be joining me in studio. We're going to continue what I started yesterday, talking about America removing itself from the Paris Accord, the Paris Agreement, and how now some are calling for population control. How should we respond? That's next here on Washington Watch. News. We can get it from many sources, but what can you trust these days? Where can you get news that doesn't make you as suspicious as you are informed? If you're looking for something better, for honest coverage of the latest news, one trusted news source I look to is the Washington Times. When preparing for the radio program and selecting guests to join me on the show, I will often read the Washington Times and have their reporters join me here on the program because I trust how they cover the news. Join me and more than 7 million readers who turn to the Washington Times every month to get real, trusted news. For a limited time only, listeners of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins will receive a special annual rate of $69.95 for the first year. Subscribe to the Washington Times and get this special offer by using my name and visiting WashingtonTimes.com/Tony Perkins. That's WashingtonTimes.com/Tony Perkins.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C. I want to invite you to join Luana and myself, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through June the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155. Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Again, the website, TonyPerkins.com. Let me remind you, we're starting the Family Research Council, launching Stand Courageous Men's Conferences. We'll be hosting these around the country. Our first one coming up a week from Friday, right outside of Cincinnati, Ohio. To find out more about how you can be a part of the Stand Courageous Men's Conferences, we'll have General Boykin will be there. I'll be there. Stu Weber, former Promise Keepers speaker, former Green Beret in Vietnam. He'll be a part of these. Bishop Larry Jackson, also a former Promise Keeper speaker, will be with us. To find out how you can be a part of these events, and I'm telling you, they're powerful. Go to TonyPerkins.com. Under episode resources, you can see that, all of the upcoming events, and you can register there. All right, continuing in studio with me, Travis Weber, Vice President of Policy and of Government Affairs. We're discussing a new publication just released this week by the Family Research Council on China, the religious freedom in China, the history, current challenges, and the proper response to a human rights crisis. And, you know, we were talking about why you should care. Well, first off, as a believer, you need to be concerned about what's happening with other believers. But from a practical policy standpoint, China is a global player, and they're exporting. They're exporting their technology that they're using for repressing religious minorities, their facial recognition, their artificial intelligence that they're using to crack down on one particular religious group, the Uyghurs, which are primarily Muslim. They're using that to track them, and they're also somewhere between 1 million to possibly 2 million of them have been placed in what is described as concentration camps. So, Travis, let's talk a little bit about the Uyghurs, because the State Department has spoken out clearly about the Uyghurs. It's one religious community there in China that has, like the Falun Gong, has been a really intense target of the Chinese government.
It has. And Tony, as you mentioned, well over 1 million estimated to be in currently detained in what the Chinese call re-education camps. But really, these are prison camps that are intending to erase the ability of influential Uyghurs from continuing to carry on their culture. Really, this whole effort against the Uyghurs in an attempt to erase their culture, which includes their moderate form of Islam, and erase their ability to just continue to live freely in this western Xinjiang area of China. So all of this so-called re-education attempts to detain, re-educate, and do a makeover on that whole area of China is driven by this desire to force the assimilation in a really coercive way of that population into mainstream Han Chinese culture and China. One of the recent items we discussed, the government sending male agents, into homes of Uyghurs after the men have been detained, and these male agents take up residence in the home and attempt to really influence the home in a subversive way, even sleeping in the same beds as the women. It's very insidious, but it's just one of many indications we've seen the Chinese government.
Yeah, these are families in which the males, have been placed into these concentration or re-education camps. And so while they're in these prison camps, they have these the government calls them relatives. They call it pair up and become family program. They're not relatives, but they act as family. They come in and every couple of months and will stay as long as 6 days and nights in the home. As you pointed out, even sleeping with the wives of these men who have been detained, sleeping in the same beds with them, and they say nothing is happening. But, you know, when you look at the reports that are coming out of some of these detention facilities and the abuse, the sexual abuse, the assaults, that the torture that's taking place, and that's not even to mention what is now, and we've talked about this on the program, but a growing body of evidence about the organ harvesting, where people's organs are being taken out. Sometimes they don't even know it. Maybe a kidney is removed, but of course in other cases they take out vital organs and they're dead. They take them out while they're still alive, and killing them, and the families never know what happened to them.
This is really horrific, and this practice has primarily historically impacted the Falun Gong community, spiritualist community in China, where it's estimated that at least 65,000 Falun Gong have had their organs harvested, and China's made an incredible profit off this practice. Patients from over 20 countries going to China to get organs. It's really sick. And
it's now, like a menu. You can actually have a menu. You can look down and see what the cost of a kidney is, cost of a heart. You name the body part, and you can you see what the price is. And you go to China, and you can get one in a relatively short period of time, a couple of weeks.
There is no reason that the free nations of the world should not be speaking out against this. Yet there is incredible pressure by China and others to silence speaking out against these obvious atrocities due to China's influence and other factors. But this is incredibly incredibly horrible practice that we need to continue to expose.
Well, you talk about nations, but we have businesses. We have the NBA. We have others here in the United States who China snaps their fingers and they jump to attention, knowing full well of the atrocities that are being perpetrated by the Chinese government.
Anyone defending the NBA's apologism or arguments for China needs to be asked whether they're going to stand by these practices of organ harvesting, which are documented. The
right.
UK, the London Tribunal, the UK Tribunal on Organ Harvesting recently coming out with a report in June. Anyone who wants to defend China needs to be asked whether they stand by these practices.
They're a secretive government, but the information is getting out, and there's enough evidence now to suggest that what we've been talking about is documented, it's true, it's happening. All right, one more time, how can folks get a copy of this latest publication by the Family Research Council on religious freedom in China?
So this is at our website, frc.org/China, and you can find more resources on religious freedom there.
All right, Travis Weber, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, folks, I want to shift gears here a little bit and go back to a topic we talked about yesterday. As I mentioned on Monday, the Secretary of State issued a letter to the United Nations saying that the United States would withdraw from the Paris Agreement. That's the climate change agreement that former president Barack Obama got America into, and citing in his letter, as I talked about earlier, was that it was an unfair economic burden imposed on American workers, businesses, and taxpayers by U.S. pledges made under the agreement. And he went on to talk about how U.S. emissions have declined 74% between 1970 and 2018. I mean, we're using technology, all right, and we're cleaning up. I'm a conservationist. I love the outdoors. I want clean air. I want clean water. But I don't want to subject our nation's sovereignty to a global body, nor do I want to wreck our economy, nor do I want to deny the fact that God created and is sustaining the earth. Now, that doesn't mean we don't have a responsibility to keep it clean. We do. But this alarmist mentality from the climate change people is anti-biblical, okay? And I'm going to back that up here this afternoon as we talk about this with David Clawson, who is with our worldview, creating our worldview initiative here at the Family Research Council. So, David, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks, Tony.
All right. The reason I want to bring this up is because on the heels of the withdrawal from the Paris Agreement, we had, more than 11,000 quote-unquote experts from around the world that are calling for a critical addition to the main strategy of the climate change people of dumping fossil fuels, you know, in going to windmills and electric cars and all of that. They also are now openly admitting there needs to be far fewer humans on the planet. And I said this 14, 15 years ago in a book, Personal Faith, Public Policy. This was a key element of the, at that time it was called global warming, now it's climate change. Population control is a key part of what they're pushing for.
No, you're absolutely right. And you pointed that out in your book, your 2008 book, actually, Personal Faith and Public Policy. But we've heard these calls before. All the way back in 1798, it was Thomas Malthus. He was saying that we need to limit the population because the world wasn't going to be able to feed this growing population. When he made that argument, I think world population was about a billion people. Today, it stands at 7.7 billion people. But I think, and you've talked about this before, but there really is a broader point here. And we've seen this time and time again throughout history, especially here in the United States, that calls for limiting the population have often been code for advancing radical left-wing movements. We've seen this before.
But it also stands in – yes, it, there's no question about that. It does. But for a Christian – a clear warning sign should be anything that stands in contradiction to Scripture. Now, God said in Genesis to be fruitful and multiply. Now, I've read that in English, and I've gone back to look at the Hebrew. I don't see any expiration date attached to that, that somehow only applied to certain people. And David talked about how children are the reward. They're a blessing from God. Blessed is a man who's the warrior whose quiver is full. I mean, the Scripture does not see children as a burden that are consuming limited resources. To the contrary, Jesus said, you know, don't forbid the children from come unto me. I mean, the children are a blessing. Jesus saw them as a blessing. God saw them as a blessing. We, too, should see them as a blessing.
Absolutely. And it is unfortunate, but the language is used, whether it's the climate, you know, these environmental activists are saying that, you know, the whole, whenever they talk about children, is that as children are just consumers rather than blessings to be received. But as Christians, we do want to think through this carefully. We want to think through the claims of the environmentalist from a biblical worldview. And the Bible does speak to this. I think there's two theological truths that we should think about as Christians. One is what I call through the category of dominion. The Bible teaches that when God created the world, he created human beings in his image, and he did charge them to exercise dominion by multiplying, by filling the earth. And this is how human flourishing is really produced. But secondly, the Bible does talk about stewardship.
Right.
The earth and its resources do hold more than just instrumental value. And Christians are called to exercise stewardship over creation because, you know, we don't own the earth. God does. And we're supposed to tend and cultivate God's earth. So we need to hold both of those, dominion and stewardship, together.
But isn't it also a denial of God's sovereignty and the fact that he created the earth? Now, of course, you know, that's been attacked,
right.
That the fact that God created the earth, but also that he sustains it in Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. The fact is that as Christians, we don't need to fear what might happen to the earth. It's in God's hands. His plans will be fulfilled. And going back for just a moment, as you pointed out historically, those that have called for population control because of looming crisis. You mentioned Malthus. You also had in 1969 out of Stanford University, Paul Ehrlich, who in his book, The Population Bomb, predicted millions of people would die of starvation in the 1970s and 80s without population control. Now, his hysteria created the way for the United Nations Population Fund, which was established in 1969 and was used to promote and fund the policies like in China, the one-child policy. Now we stand here in the year 2019, virtually nothing he wrote came to pass. So I would say to those who are calling for population control because there's a climate crisis on the horizon, you know, you want to make sure you're on the right side of history here. Because all of those historical, I would rather say hysterical, voices have called for population control have been proven wrong with time. I think as Christians, we're safe to stand on the side of God and what he says about children and what he says about controlling this earth in which we inhabit.
That's well said. And as Christians, you know, it's important to realize when we see a headline like this, behind a headline is a worldview. And as Christians, we have the categories of God's sovereignty, realizing that we worship a good God, a good creator who has plans for us. Now, what you're seeing from the other side is a repudiation of the Christian worldview, but also an embrace of a naturalism worldview, of a Darwinian materialist worldview that sees the natural world as all we have.
Right.
And if the natural world is all we have, then this hysteria, it makes sense.
Yeah.
If this is all we have and we're facing an existential crisis, you know, it makes sense to kind of run down this route and say that climate change is an existential threat. Even in the first Democrat debate, you had four or five candidates. They were asked, what's the most existential threat facing the United States? And rather than pointing to terrorism or China, they said climate change. And that's what those are the implications of a naturalistic worldview rather than a Christian worldview that does understand God as being sovereign and being the creator of the world.
And when we look at these issues, we need to look at them through the lenses of Scripture. And what God has to say, and those things should be measured accordingly. David, we're out of time. We're going to have to come back to this issue because it's one that I think there's so much to be said about it because there's so much layered into this. All right, folks, out of time. Thanks so much for joining us. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul, where he says in Ephesians 6, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, prepared, and taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.